following program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. You may have noticed that one Whole Foods Market store is not like the other. We're proud that each of our stores has its own quirks, a direct connection to the surrounding community, and buys and sells their own products. Whether it's artisanal chocolates exclusive to Bowery, small batch pickles in Chelsea, or a featured craft beer on tap at West 97th, you'll find that each store is a little bit different than the next. With six Manhattan locations, Whole Foods Market offers a taste of every neighborhood. Come see us in Tribeca, Bowery, Union Square, Chelsea, Columbus Circle, or the Upper West Side. Open 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. For more information, visit www.wholefoodsmarket.com.
Welcome to this afternoon's program of Unfiltered. This is your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, with my co-host,
Brian DeMarco.
And we're here at March 22nd, second day of spring. Sun is shining here at Roberta's. And quick thank you to our engineer and producer, Jack Ainsley, styling us out this afternoon.
That would be Happy Jack for anyone local.
Happy Jack. So we have a great show today. We have a special guest, Eric Arnold, here from bottlenotes.com. He is the editorial director of Bottlenotes, and it's e-newsletter, The Daily Sip. So we're going to be talking with Eric, but first going to kind of do a little recap of some things that have happened in the past week in the wine world, starting with a little moment for Japan, actually, with the sake breweries, which many of them have disappeared in the wake of the disasters that rocked Japan over the past week. So
we need to give a shout out to Japan and our folks in Tokyo. And if you see sake on the shelves, everyone go out and order it, buy it, support farmers. Mm-hmm. And the only way they're going to get back is if we support their products.
Yeah, the destruction to the sake industry is certainly not the worst that Japanese industries have suffered, but the worst hit breweries are in the Miyagi prefecture in the epicenter of the earthquake, as well as in Fukushima, the location of the seriously damaged nuclear power plant. So,
yeah, I mean, it's crazy stuff, and obviously there's the loss of life and everything, but for the purpose of our show, we try to support our farmers, and we know that there's a lot of agriculture out there that people are afraid of, and we've seen some of the stuff on the news and sort of the hype and scare about spinach and other local grown things that have radiation. So the best we can do is support them, and hopefully if it's on the shelf now, that means it was made before an earthquake. So let's buy it, support it.
Go to Bohemian and drink it. And then in other news, like the Denver Business Journal released a report today that craft beer sales are up 12% in 2010. So that's quite a figure to jump in 1 year.
Well, it's off a small base, but I think that, you know, people are starting to get it.
Yeah. I mean, this beer we're having now, what is this? This is the Omegang Rare VOS on draft here at Roberta's, which is delicious.
And it's upstate, supporting upstate New York. And so there's a lot of great brew being made all over the country. And we're happy to support that, too.
Yeah. And lastly, other piece of news, the most expensive wine in Australia has been sold. A recently released Shiraz with a perfect score from an influential wine publication cost a hefty $700 Australian, which is about $700-$800 a bottle.
What's the name of that wine, Aaron?
Grange.
What vintage?
That was, let's see, which vintage was this? 2005.
So the great Bordeaux vintage has some carryover in Australia?
Great Bordeaux vintage of 2005?
Correct.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe. I guess so. I mean, I haven't, I have to delve into this article a little bit more, but I just saw this released today on the news, and Australia, you don't really hear as much about Australia and their wine prices skyrocketing as you do Bordeaux, especially in Asia market these days. But this was in Hong Kong, which may have well gone to one of the high-end collectors.
Well, it's interesting to note, I was at the Acromero auction on Saturday, and there was a lot for a vertical of Grange that was estimated between $1,200 and $2,000, and I think it went for $2,400 over the estimate. So,
really?
You know, maybe Grange is having a bit of a resurgence.
Well, this is four cases of the Laird, when Laird is made by Torbrek. So that's in the Barossa Valley. So I'm sure that we could give Grange a run for its money. But
likely.
Well, we're going to introduce our guest, Eric Arnold, but take a short break just beforehand. So please stay tuned.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
You are listening to Unfiltered. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick and Brian DeMarco. And I'm going to pass the mic over to Brian, who's going to introduce our guest this afternoon.
Yes, everyone. We have the lovely and talented Eric Arnold with us today.
Lovely. I like that when men call men lovely.
It's kind of creepy.
And it's a little creepy.
Stop touching my leg.
Well, you know, he's a mensch of the highest proportions, and I actually met Eric recently, so it's rare when men make new men friends at an adult age, and I kind of feel a little warm inside myself. But he is an author, an editor, and an all-around wine guy, and I was familiar with his work when he wrote a book about New Zealand. I was in South Australia, okay? So he wrote a book about Grange.
No, it's Laird.
No, so, I was fortunate enough to get a copy of that book, and we have a mutual friend in Bruce Kerner, who we've talked about on this show
before. Definitely, sure.
So without further ado, I will introduce Mr. Eric Arnold.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming.
No, yeah. My pleasure. Well, geez, it's Roberta's. I mean, I'm not going to turn that down.
Yeah, you're like, I think I know how to get there.
Yeah
I've been there a few times.
Yeah. Well, free pizza and beer. I mean,
yeah, well, and also I heard James Suckling canceled, so I was happy to come in and, you know.
Well,
yeah. I'm 99 points on this beer, I want to say.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you know, there is a short list of people we have, and so you may be another go-to guest when someone else cancels.
So. Well, I'm a short man for a short list, so all good.
No. Well, I'm sure a lot of the listeners have heard of the site that you're the editorial director of called Bottle Notes, bottlenotes.com, if anyone wants to hit it on the web right now as we're discussing. And also you oversee the blog The Daily Sip.
Yeah, and so, that's basically, it's an e-newsletter just like, you know, like Daily Candy or Thrillist, all that kind of stuff. But we just focus on booze. So sometimes it's... sometimes we actually unearth something that nobody else has. It's kind of exciting. Gets the old sort of news junkie thing going. But, you know, most of the time we just try to focus on really, you know, basic things for, you know, anybody who's just looking for something good to drink on any particular night. So we try to keep it really simple and not get too wine geeky with it.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, Eric, tell me, you know, I know that you have some actual literary chops. And so I know you were doing some stuff for Forbes. Tell me how the Forbes job led you to the Bottle Notes job.
Well, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, you know, Forbes was at a really interesting point in its history, it probably still is. And it was a great publication to work for. I really enjoyed it there. And I actually got to a point where I had a choice of sticking with covering lifestyle topics or covering politics and opinions at a, you know, pretty right you know, capitalist tool bag, you know, magazine. Correct. Was not really my cup of tea. And so I actually would have been a lot of fun, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do. So, and it was actually the same day they asked me to do that, the Bottlenose came along and said, hey, we've got this e-newsletter that's really gathering steam and we need somebody to, who's professional to handle it. And I thought, you know what, it'd be fun to try and do something with nothing really and try and take something to the next level.
Cool. Well, I'm going to interrupt for 1 second because we have a caller on the line. So, don't be scared.
You guys are looking like that's never happened before.
No.
Does your wife know you're here, Eric?
No, actually. Should we cancel the strippers?
Hello, someone on the line?
Hi, Aaron. This is Douglas in Chicago.
Hi, Douglas. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I have a question for Eric.
Definitely.
And it's because he's worked at so many different places, like the startup retailer and the magazine Wine Spectator, and he's actually worked the land making some wine. I'm just wondering how those work environments are different from each other.
Well, I guess it's probably like it's like gateway drugs, you know, you go from marijuana to eventually to cocaine to eventually to, you know, angel dust, and then it all crashes down and you wake up and you're like, oh, you're fine and everything's good.
And you had to play Charlie Sheen in Celebrity Rehab.
Well, no. He and I are old pals. No. Yeah. No, I mean, I guess it's, you know, it's just like anything else, you know, in life, you know, you take what you learn in one place and you apply as much of it as you can to the next. And,
sure.
You know, there's some overlap and sometimes there isn't. And you just have to improvise or ask questions and you figure it out.
Now, is this Douglas from Chicago Pinot?
That's me.
All right, cool. So I know that you had mentioned he is a listener, frequent listener, actually.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
And you have a blog as well. Can you tell us the name of that blog?
Sure. It's called Chicago Pinot 2.0.
Uh-huh.
And you can read it at chicagopinot.wordpress.com.
Okay.
And I love emails. You can email me at chicagopinot@gmail.com.
Now, you're studying for the WSET?
I'm trying it again on May 21st, so
well, I imagine,
any advice, any prayers, came close with the essays, but not
well, I would get. I would subscribe to the Daily Sip, you know, that's Eric's e-newsletter, and you can get a lot of information from that, and then Bottle Notes also has recommendations of wines to taste, and one of the best things I think I could recommend in terms of wine study is just taste, and write stuff down.
Okay. Absolutely. The best thing is to educate your palate and to see whether you agree with what people are writing about wines. And having your own opinion is probably more important than, you know, kowtowing to someone else's opinion.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, honestly, I think someone who was taking the Master of Wine exam was telling me a while back that, you know, even if you're wrong on whatever wine it is they placed in front of you, as long as you do a good job supporting your argument and say and state your opinion, you know, effectively and clearly, you know, that's really what matters. You know, sort of stick to your guns, but also, you know, really be able to, you know, emphasize the points that you want to, and you'll be fine.
It's kind of like the Republicans in the late, you know, 2008. It was
gotta bring politics into this, huh?
If you're wrong, be epically wrong and support it till, you know, death do you part.
Thanks for the call, Douglas.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Nice. All right. So.
So you sure that wasn't a plant, Mr.?
I swear to God, I grew up in Naperville before my family moved to New Jersey. I never met Douglas in Chicago. But
so
next time I'm there.
Back to Bottle Notes. You know, I think that it's interesting because Barter House, my company, is a supporter of Bottle Notes, and I know that Sherry Lehman is a supporter of you guys. Tell me what you guys are doing that is talking to the new drinker that maybe something that Wine Spectator isn't doing.
Well, I think with wine, it's not even really the right comparison. I mean, Wine Spectator is talking to, you know, olds. Collectors. I mean, there are some
enthusiasts.
Consumers
enthusiasts.
Yeah, they're enthusiasts, but there's also, I mean, I think with, you and I have had this discussion before where, you know, a lot of times somebody in a, you know, big box store in Pennsylvania feels lost. So what do they need? They need a wine score, or at least just something as a guide. But as you and I have said, that 91 points, it doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't really carry on anything other than just, hey, this brand slapped a score on it. I mean, we know that more went into the tasting process than that. But for the person who's completely naive and walks into the shop and they just see that, what if they hate the wine?
Right.
You know? So the main thing that, along with the deli sip that Bottlenose has, is basically a similar thing like Cellar Tracker, where if
peer,
you...
Peer reviews?
Yeah, peer reviews. So if you try wine and you like it, you can use either your iPhone, we have an app on there, or go to our site and basically say, hey, I tried this, you know, $10 Pinot Grigio, and it was awesome. You guys should all try it too. And that way, somebody like you who's in one of those stores, and they see it, and they go, all right, what do I do? They can look it up. And you know what? If there's no rating for it, it's just like anything else. They can take a plunge, take a try with it. And if they love it, they can post a great, you know, rating and note of it. Or they can post a terrible one and say, hey, everybody, don't buy this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something like that, coming from a real person, carries more weight, ultimately, than, you know, a number from a person or a place that you know exists, but you don't necessarily know that you should trust it.
Well, I mean, when you think about the retail experience of going into like a video shop and like an old film shop or a retail store where you see the staff picks too, and there's a little write up, and I'm more compelled to go with what, you know, store kind of gets me in terms of a consumer aspect, as opposed to just a rating system to check one of those items out, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's like Siskel and Ebert back in the day, thumbs up, thumbs down, you know?
Yeah.
I was actually, cause I was bored one day. I was looking for a clip from, some 80s movie. I can't remember what it was, but then I came across the Siskel and Ebert review, and this movie, whatever it was considered a classic. People still love it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them loved it and one of them hated it. So, you know, what happens if you're in the video store today and you see, okay, it has one thumbs up, one thumbs down? That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, well, there aren't any video stores around
That's
anymore,
true.
Are there?
No. That's what iTunes is for with the star ratings.
No,
it's the same
thing.
Well,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that, it was Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo. That was your favorite. And they were trying to save the rec center. And I know that that's your big thing. You know, you love, you know, obscure 80s movies.
Like actually, I'm, you know, all right. So, favorite John Hughes movie? Go without no hesitation. Which one is it?
You know, I've got to go with Ducky. You know,
I've
got to be the Ducky.
16 Candles.
16 Candles. No. Breakfast Club. See, I'm going to say Weird Science.
Wow,
oh,
okay.
That was his too. That's right.
So, right, you know, right.
Happy Jack. Who do we like?
I don't know if Jack can answer you right
I
now.
Don't know, we can.
We'll
okay.
We'll get his answer during the break and get back to you on that one. But so how has social media affected Bottlenose in the past couple of years since you've launched?
Well, it's been huge. I mean, I've only been there for a year now, but
okay.
just the well, look at it this way. I mean, just likes on Facebook or people who follow us on Facebook went from about, I think, 3,000 or 4,000 from the time I showed up to over 16,000-17,000 today. So, I mean, that's pretty
a
huge leap
year.
In a very
short
amount of time.
So if you're logged into your Facebook account and you go onto the Bottlenose page, I think I was on the Bottlenose page yesterday, and you can actually comment if you're already logged in on Facebook right away, right?
Yeah. So, well, we do two things. Well, mainly it's the Daily Sip page on Bottlenose. So I think it's just facebook.com/DailySip. And then, but also if people leave a comment on the actual edition for that day below it, they can also do the same thing on the Facebook page as well.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, when I showed up, there was, there was some activity from some regulars, but now just because of Facebook and because of Twitter and because we actually take an effort to constantly engage with anybody who asks us a question or wants to open a dialogue, you know, all of that stuff has gone up significantly. So
mm-hmm.
a lot of times now you'll see a lot of people engaging in conversation with each other based on whatever item we've run that day.
With the Facebook push, have you seen your demographic change or the engagement change among the core audience?
How do you mean? Like the demographic in terms of...
Of who's using your medium, who looks at your advice, you know, an age break, a demographic for maybe income or, you know, just find that person from a media demographic.
You know, we always like to say that we skew toward the younger demographic who's looking for more guidance, who feels too young for Wine Spectator or whatever. But honestly, what I see when I look at Facebook and I look at the people who are commenting on whatever item we've put up that day, or maybe we put up a news story that we thought was interesting, like, you know, like the thing about craft beer sales going up. Sometimes we'll just post that and have a comment with it and say,
mm-hmm.
hey, what do you guys think?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're from all over. I mean, it's crazy. I would have totally thought they would just be skewed younger, but there are some people my mother's age in Decatur saying, oh, you know, I tried this Gewurztraminer the other day. And, you know, I mean, you'd be surprised how many people you are just not expecting to be into this stuff really are and want to talk about it. Yeah. And they turned to the web to do it.
Now, and then Bottle Notes also, you know, you sell wine. You are an online retailer.
Actually, we're not.
You're not. Okay.
The company was originally founded to be. Uh-huh. And then eventually it just, you know, the founders decided that it made more sense to be in the social media and media space. And we hold events as well. You know, people show up and they try, you know, 100 different wines in a given night. And, you know, we're just in D.C. on Friday for an event down there. That was awesome, actually. And but no, the retail end is completely handled by Sherry Lehman. So okay. we just decided okay. that's something they've been doing forever. So they decided that they wanted to handle it. So they do.
So your site links up to their sort of retail capacity.
Right. So okay. if there's a wine that you look up on our site, hey, what did Brian think of it? And he says he gives it 5 stars and you click on it, it'll ultimately take you to a shopping cart on Sherry Lehman.
Okay.
Which cool. is great. So I think that them doing the fulfillment and is probably a wise move because that's an entirely different, you know, skill set and something they're much more adept at doing.
Oh, they can do it in their sleep, you know, and that's, you know, there's no reason for us to try and do their job, and they're certainly not going to try and do a media job. Mm-hmm. At least I mm-hmm. hope not. I don't know.
But. Well, I'll give the official shout out to Sherry Lehman, as that's my one of my other alma maters, and I worked there about a decade ago, so I think that they do a very good job
in
helping out, and they're actually very competitive in that kind of space where your buyers and listeners are probably tuned into. So it's interesting. It's interesting to see the reach of retail now when everyone's on the web and everyone has an opinion about wine, but it's not like you're shopping on Amazon and you can just get that bottle sent to you. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, and you can now in many instances, but I think there's a lot of legal rigmarole and, you know, what if the wine comes in, it's 100 degrees. Like, you know, I think there's a lot of fulfillment issues still. And I wonder if we'll ever be to a place where you can get a bottle of California wine, you know, sent to your house and it's going to be the same as having it, you know, your local retailer sell it to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're getting there because I ordered some stuff from Oregon a couple of weeks ago. And when I was on the phone with them, they just said, well, you know, just so you know, it's still a little cold, so we might wait. So, you know, give it a month or whatever. And, you know, and they said, but don't worry, we watch the temperatures every day. I was like, wow, that's service with a smile.
Well, but that's great because when it leaves them, you're in the hands of the UPS man.
Yeah, well, and he drank it all. 4 empty bottles showed up, asshole.
Yes, yes.
Well, we're gonna switch gears for a minute because I do want to get in on a little bit on the topic of your book that you wrote a couple years back and how you got into wine and your experience in New Zealand working there at the winery Alan Scott and where the New Zealand wine industry is today, as it's certainly has grown since I imagine the time you were there.
Yeah, probably what doubled or maybe even tripled actually in size since I was there 5-6 years ago.
So. I mean, and also before you go off on that tangent, I mean, think about your answer in terms of is New Zealand the next Australia? And are we going to see a glut of wine? And how does the quality quotient play out for the producers that are still interested in doing quality?
How do you want me to answer those? Which order?
Let's start with you. Let's start with you and your book, First Crush.
Right. First big crush.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, it was only a couple years ago. I'd hope you'd have a small crush before then.
I had many small crushes. They were all disasters. I can't even, can't even tell you. Yeah, so I didn't know anything about wine. I felt like and there were no books out there, no magazines that spoke to me in a way that, you know, I wanted to be spoken to. And honestly, one of the first books I read that that really got me interested in food, for example, was Kitchen Confidential.
Okay.
And, you know, and I thought, well, here's somebody who really could take the whole experience of working in a New York restaurant kitchen and really explain it to somebody and really scare you to death and make sure this is something you never want to do with your life. And so I thought, you know what, that book doesn't necessarily exist for wine. I don't know, maybe wine's a great experience. I don't know. But I realized that if I researched it, I would just be scared and I wouldn't go do it. And I was 28 at the time. And I was like, well, you know, nobody's going to come along and offer me $1 million a year job to sit around and, you know, drink all day. So it's like, well, I got to just do something different. And so I'd been on vacation in New Zealand once and I loved the wines. I still drank them regularly. And because at the time that was all I could really afford as well. And so because back then they were like $8, which was great. But the good ones were $8 was what it was. And so I just got this crazy idea and I thought, why don't I just email this a few wineries and, you know, and see if I can, you know, let them put a roof over my head and I'll come and I'll learn everything. And because I think I was so naive about the whole idea of such a thing and because they were so naive about somebody you know, sending an email like that. They said, mm-hmm. sure, come on down.
Volunteering their time and their energy.
Yeah, and they were like, yeah, come on down. And so, and then of course, they forgot that I was showing up. So I emailed from Auckland like 2 days before. I'm like, hey, I'll be down there in a couple of days. Yeah, I just got to sort out my visa up here. And they're like, oh, crap, that guy's actually, she's actually here.
That's amazing. You know?
So, yeah, and then I was there for another 14 months or so. And
can't,
you know,
get rid of you. Yeah.
No, they couldn't. Yeah, and actually, they were very happy when I left.
So what was better, the sheep or the wine?
Let me tell you. Well, sheep never say no, but neither does wine. So, and sometimes if you have enough of one, you want to have the other, and you can reverse that.
Wow! Yeah.
So it's exciting times. Believe me, when you're living in the middle of nowhere. No, I'm just kidding.
So then, fast forward to a couple years later, the book's already on the market, and it documents your experience from, you know, working in the vineyards, picking, to the cellar experience, to prepping the vineyards for the next harvest.
Weekend shepherd.
Working Sherpa, yeah. So now, fast forward, and you have the industry where it is today. So talk a little bit about that for us.
Yeah, I mean, well, geez, I think I'm... can't quote myself directly, but I think Marlborough might have harvested something like 80,000 tons of grapes when I was there, and now they're probably at, like, you know, 200,000. I mean, it's an insane increase. Mm-hmm. So I put up I used to work at Forbes, and I put up a blog post a few days ago about the current state of the industry. And if you have the patience to read all 3,700 words that I wrote, I just couldn't stop it. But I really got
is
decided.
Is it a rant or is it a?
No, it's actually not a rant. I decided I needed to explain, like, the economics of it as well. Like,
so it's an essay.
I would say it's an essay. But at the end of it, there's an explanation at the beginning as to sort of the quote mess that New Zealand's in now, which with oversupply, not enough quality driven producers. You know, you have like a supermarket in the UK who's basically saying, "Hey, winery who's been around for 25 years, why should I pay you $10 a bottle for your awesome Sauvignon Blanc when the winery down the road from you mm-hmm. will give me this whole bladder full of wine that I can put on a tanker and ship over to the UK and I can bottle it and I can sell it for $5." And so both wines wind up on the shelves in places like the UK and even to the US to some extent. Mm-hmm. And the consumer who doesn't know any better is going to go, well, I'm going with the $5 one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people are talking about the damage that this is doing to the New Zealand brand, the Marlborough brand, so on and so forth. And the argument that I've made in this essay, as it were, is basically, you know what, it's okay. It's not the end of the world.
Right.
It's also that you have to understand that if you look at every other established wine region on the planet, whether it's Bordeaux, South Africa, Napa, they have these, you know, select few awesome producers at the top that command top dollar. Then you have sort of a wide middle tier of, you know, $15, $20 wines that you can get great quality out of. You might have a few missteps here and there. And then below that, you just have oodles and oodles of just low quality wine. And some of it actually turns out to be, or cheap wine, and some of it turns out to be great bang for the buck. Some of it isn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at Bordeaux. 44% of what those guys make is sold in French supermarkets for like a couple euros a bottle.
Right.
So this is just part of being a global player. Mm-hmm, and it sucks for these guys in this little island nation in the South Pacific because they're going, you know, hey, look what's happening to us around the world. But it's really not that bad. They're really now an officially established global player. They're just learning that it's not as glamorous as they thought it was going
to
be.
So this had to happen to them for almost them to go through this to be legitimate at this point. I mean, like,
I think so.
It's happened to Australia, it's happened to California, and now it's happened to New Zealand.
I mean, the difference with Australia, though, is it's just on such a massive scale, though.
Right,
I mean,
right.
That's the other thing. And also, we have to realize about Australia is that, you know, they were basically, the Australians do everything big, you know? So, you know, these guys are also farming rice. There is no reason to farm rice in Australia. And so when they complain there's not enough water, the grapevines are taking it, and the government is basically giving money to farmers to plant grapevines, and everybody's getting in a tizzy over that. And mm-hmm. it's like you guys just have to realize what's appropriate for mm-hmm. the particular piece of land that you're planting. And mm-hmm. and you know, with a place like Marlborough, yeah, they're going to have a shakeout, and some growers are going to go out of business, and their vines are going to be ripped out. That's nothing on the scale of what's happened in France with vine pulls or in Australia. You know, it's going to be painful, but it's not nearly as painful as it would be in some of these other places.
Well, what do you think are the best varietals that are grown in Australia and then New Zealand? And what do you think the global market will do and maybe change people, farmers, you know, habits. For example, when people ripped up, you know, everything and planted Chardonnay, and now they're ripping up Chardonnay and planting other things. And so, you know, there's we hear that there's going to be this massive Riesling resurgence. So I know they're planting Riesling now in New Zealand. Do you think that's something that might take off?
Well, I mean, Riesling's been growing in New Zealand for 30 years, and there's some great Riesling there. So it's, you know, look,
on a small scale.
Absolutely. But, you know, a few years ago, people there were talking about Viognier being the next big thing. And then they went, oops, sorry. But, you know, it happens, though. I mean, look at car companies. They go, everybody's going to want smaller cars. And then all of a sudden, right, they go, oh, crap, nobody wants smaller cars. They want big cars again. You know, and it takes 3 years to put that car into production. It's just, you know, it's mm-hmm. supply, demand. Some of it's getting lucky. Some of it's being right. smart. And, you know, it's... Yeah, I mean, I think, but to answer the first part of your question, I think some weird things are going to happen. I think people are going to start to realize, one, that Chardonnay is actually awesome out of Australia. People are going to go, holy cow, who knew? Some of these are incredible. Pinot Noir out of New Zealand has already been seeing this resurgence, but the 09s, you know, people were talking about the 08s in Oregon, the 09s in New Zealand are every bit as good. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's always just new surprises around the corner, and that's the fun of the wine business, really.
That's amazing. Well said. Yeah. Thank you for that quick wrap up. I mean, I love New Zealand wines, and I'd like to see that they're having the growing pains like everyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's a good sign for them.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, can you point our listeners to your sites?
Yes. Okay. So you can just check out my book on Amazon. So the book is First Big Crush. And then you can check out bottlenotes.com, where you can also sign up for the Daily Sip. And you can also check out Brian DeMarco's myfavoritehorror.com. So.
Wow. Yeah. Is that on Forbes this week?
It is. That'll be on Forbes next week.
Thank you. Thank you.
Title of your next book. And anything else coming up for you in the new year that's exciting?
Was it a new year? I don't know.
Yeah. We're 3 months into the new year. It's, you know, you got 9 months to go. If there's nothing, then
I don't know.
If it's nothing, we'll have you back in the fall, and so maybe have some other more musings and ramblings.
In the fall, you promised me next week. Was that bad?
No, that's what the sheep. Take us out, Aaron. Take us out.
Thanks again, Eric, for joining us. Eric Arnold from Bottle Notes, and this is your co-host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, with my Brian DeMarco. Yeah.
Pinky swear.
Hey guys.
And our awesome Happy Jack Home producer, Alone 2. Engineer.
Home Alone 2.
Home Alone 2.
Yeah, that's my answer.
Oh,
here he nice. Comes.
John
Nice.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Beer Sessions Radio. Beyond the human and environmental casualties of the triple threat disaster in Japan, there will likely also be losses to our collective food culture, from miso and sake makers to outstanding fisheries. With help from the New York State Brewers Association, the Good Beer Seal, Beer Sessions Radio, and craft breweries alike, Jimmy Carboni is hoping to raise funds that will go directly to Hitachino, an excellent Japanese brewery, through a benefit at Brooklyn Brewery next Monday, March 28th, from 7 to 10 p.m. In addition to beer, there'll be food from the Meat Hook, Jimmy's No. 43, Waterfront Ale House, and a few local Japanese restaurants. All money raised will go to Kyuchi Brewery and Hitachino Beers, which they will distribute via humanitarian aid locally. To date, the brewery, which lost 500 bottles in the earthquake and suffered some damage to its physical plant, is filtering and bottling water for its community and providing them with food. You can read a letter about the quake's aftermath to Jimmy from Toshiyuki Kyuchi, the brewery owner, on his site. And you can buy tickets to the benefit on brownpapertickets.com/event/166978. That's brownpapertickets.com/event/166978. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? to kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Momofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.